This is Cultural Mixtapes. I'm Tejas Srinivasan. Welcome to the show. I consume a lot of food content, and I mean a lot. From my TikTok feed to random Netflix shows to miscellaneous Instagram accounts I follow when I'm bored, food pretty much accounts for most of my algorithm. I search for good writing about food, but oftentimes I find the regular restaurant reviews and traditional food writing a bit monotonous and just distant. Food and novels is also a fascinating study. From the bizarre futuristic showings of abundance in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, to Leopold Bloom's slightly disconcerting organ and innards extravaganza in Ulysses, writers have chronicled the simple act of eating in countless ways. I came across a novel that used food as a tool for reflection into the life and mind of a few characters. Rachel Kong's first novel, Goodbye Vitamin, is about a woman who goes back home to care for her father, who started to develop Alzheimer's. And Kong meditates on this family by refocusing on their daily activities. From cooking, to eating, to random conversations, we see how mundane routines can change, bend, and break under the stress of illness. Food was my entry point into the novel, but my discussion with Rachel starts to incorporate other ideas that she was interested in during her writing process. We've talked a lot about memory on this show, and Rachel's very interested in the simultaneous perfection and imperfection of memory. What happens when a character goes about their daily life on a faulty memory, and what happens when everyone else has to watch the memory of someone they love dissipate? We take a step back and start to think about the memory of a writer as well. How does a profound mistrust of one's memory change the way they perceive scenes and characters and ideas in a novel? We thread these ideas in with Rachel's new novel, Real Americans, which is out April 30th from Knopf. Her new novel is entirely different in style and structure to the first one. It weaves between two timelines that show the intersections of two vastly different families, immigrants from China and a pharmaceutical empire with generational wealth. We talk through her writing process for this novel and how she sees part of it as a response to the world we've lived in since 2016. The novel's not overtly political, but you can start to see what Rachel's project is with this new work, and we dive into how she spent the last few years writing it. This was a fun chat that drifted between profound discussions about memory to Rachel's experiences on a comedic food podcast called Recipe Club. Links to Rachel's website, as well as to pre-order her new book, are all in the show notes. Real Americans is out April 30th. Hope you enjoy the show. Rachel Kong, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Your novel from 2017, Goodbye Vitamin, is about a woman in her late 20s who moves back home for a year to take care of her father, who has started to develop Alzheimer's. So I want to start with the obvious question. Where did the beginnings of this book start from?
So I was really interested in writing about memory. That's a subject that I had been interested in for a really long time. I think especially maybe starting in college when memorization is such an important thing for success in classes and things like that. And I had always thought of myself as sort of having like a less than great memory. So I really wanted to write a book that I think captured the strangeness of memory and sort of, I really wanted to write a book that was about the sort of differences in memory that we can all have. You know, I think something that has always really fascinated me is the fact that I can remember one thing and you can remember something completely different. Mm-hmm. And we might both have the same experiences in the same room with one another, for example, but still have completely different rememberings of that instance. And so I was really interested in writing about that. Just like, how do you have a relationship when the relationships can be founded on this thing that is so faulty for all of us. So I was interested in memory and so it was sort of, it started there. And then something that happened as I was writing the book was that my grandmother, who had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, sort of got worse and worse in her condition. And so I was really interested in just sort of putting onto the page some of the things that we saw as we sort of took care of her in her, you know, during her decline, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Something I noticed about the novel is like you're putting a stressor on relationships of this crumbling memory. And in the process of thinking about Alzheimer's, you interrogate a lot of everyday activities that seem simple, like cooking, cleaning, and driving, and you paint them in a new light because of this memory that you're exploring. Was that part of the goal with the novel, trying to refocus energies onto basic everyday activities?
Yeah, absolutely. I love that you brought that up because that's something I was thinking about and I really wanted to do. I wanted to write a book that had sort of this texture of everyday life and was about the really mundane things that happen day to day, but mm-hmm. as you said, become so much more significant when, you know, someone is experiencing life with a disease like Alzheimer's that really yeah. makes some normal functions, you know, normal in quotes, like very difficult. So yeah, I think it's just exactly as you said, I was really interested in seeing our day-to-day lives in a new way through this lens.
And the novel is written like a diary, sort of, and you juggle perspectives quite a bit between first person, sometimes even the second person. What goes into a decision like that? Does that have something to do with the content of the novel itself?
It definitely has to do with the content and has to do with what we were just talking about wanting to capture that daily experience. If for anyone who reads the book, it's very much a, as you say, the sort of like journal-like document. It's not exactly your traditional novel that has, you know, maybe this very strong plot with something really big and major that happens in the middle. Nobody, mm-hmm. I like to say that nobody is born and nobody dies in this book. It's just one like somewhat ordinary year in a young woman's life. But I think that the form of the book in these very short entries was a way to, just like bring up little observations too that the narrator has. Sometimes some have more and less to do with like what's actually happening in the plot or the family dynamics themselves, but it's really a way for her to sort of bring the reader along in her like day-to-day life, essentially. I think you really get to know a character based on what they notice. And mm-hmm. so the diary format was sort of a way to, I think, bring you a little bit closer to the narrator, you know, as you're noticing what she notices, you sort of, yeah, like meld with her consciousness a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. And then did you have any influences for a novel like that? Because that's such a distinct style. And like, I can remember similar reading experiences that are set up in this way. Who'd you look for when you started this?
I think that I came to novels like this quite late in my reading life. I didn't even mm-hmm. really know they existed. But once I found them, I was so thrilled and excited that fiction could be written in this way, you know, in the sort of like more fragmented PC, for lack of a better word, you know, mm-hmm. fashion. And so one of the books that really informed this book was a book called Why Did I Ever? By the author Mary Robeson.
Okay.
And it's a book that is, yeah, just like these little fragments. And it's rumored that she wrote the entirety of the book while I think parked in a parking lot. She mm-hmm. would get away in the middle of the night from her children, sit in a parking lot and just write these sentences on little scraps of paper on index cards.
Oh, wow.
And a whole book was written this way. And so I think I was both excited by, I mean, the book itself, it is amazing in how it creates a whole, you know, narrative with just these very short fragments, essentially. Like you get a real sense of who these people are. You understand who the narrator is just in these very short sentences and really simple language. And so that was a book that was really inspiring to me for that, but also just the way that she wrote it, you know, I thought like, okay, it's writing a novel is literally like putting together, you know, small amounts of work into something much larger. It always seemed so daunting to me, but I think when I thought of it that way, it was a lot easier to fathom. A book called Speedboat by Renata Adler is another influence. It was often, you know, women writers who wrote in this way. I think now of like Sarah Manguso is another great writer who likes to write in sort of these shorter bursts. But to me, there's something that is so like honest about that form. It really feels like, oh, this is what it's like to be a person. I don't necessarily think in these like long, like perfect, you know, narratives. I'm not actually the kind of person who, you know, sits at a campfire and can like spin this amazing yarn. Like, I don't think of myself as that kind of writer, but I think that's okay. There's lots of different kinds of writers. And that's definitely like what comes to mind, I think, when you think of a storyteller or someone who can just sort of, you know, like just spin this like very grand tale. But with this book, I was interested in something else and interested in this other way of telling a story that still felt so much like life.
Lovely. Yeah, when you say that Mary Robeson wrote in the car, that reminds me of what Alexander Chee told me. He says he likes to write now on his phone in the parking lot when he's just waiting for stuff. I was like, oh, I guess that's how novels are made.
Yeah. I mean, if you have enough of those notes, it's a novel.
I want to hone in on this idea of memory because it's obviously so prevalent in your first book. Parts of your forthcoming novel called Real Americans, coming April of 2024, involves memories being excavated and understood, but the way you treat it is like, especially in the first novel, is memory is faster and quicker and ahead of us, and we have to do our best to keep up with it. So you said something at the beginning, you don't think your memory is very good and how that sort of inspires your interest in it. Can you say more about that and just how you think of memory fundamentally affecting you?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I think, I mean, the really honest answer about where this book began is it began sort of after a breakup, I think. And I was thinking about, so it happened after a breakup, and I was thinking about what I mentioned earlier, you know, why is this happening? Why is this breakup happening? I remember things a certain way. I remember things being pretty good, but obviously this person thinks something else completely. I think the question of, sorry, can you remind me what your question is?
When you said at the beginning, because you don't have a good memory, it makes you think about memory more. How did that relationship start?
Yeah, I did mention it started sort of in college and school, I think, because, you know, it's a place of, there's so much memorization required, right? When you're taking tests, you're sort of asked to perform these like feats of memory. And I have just never been that kind of a learner. Like, I have succeeded enough to get by, and I have like developed my own tricks for remembering stuff, but I don't think of myself as this like amazing like memory artist at all. And I think I was like, you know, quite envious of people, many of my classmates who seem to find it so easy to just memorize things, you know, recite them back, internalize them in ways that I just like found really difficult. And I think that like struggling with memory is in part why I am a writer too. You know, I'm using writing as a way to make documents and just remember my life essentially, you know? So I think so it's all entwined for me, I think, writing and memory. Like, there's not really writing for me without that desire to sort of make a document. You know, in the past, it would have been a document sort of like what's even happening in my life. But I think now it's also still, so serving that function, but it's more about, okay, who am I as a person as I'm writing this particular book or this particular story? Like, what are the things that I'm interested in and thinking about? And I think that will always be really fascinating to me, like writing as a way to sort of document and keep in touch with who I used to be. I mean, I think I'm going to totally misquote this, but Joan Didion has a beautiful line about keeping a journal or keeping a diary. And mm-hmm. It's something like, you know, we're well advised to keep on just like nodding terms with the people that we used to be, and even people that we maybe found maybe now find to be like embarrassing or kind of annoying. Writing is just sort of a way to keep in touch with all of those past people too.
Lovely. Have you read The Years by Annie Ernaux? Because I feel like the process you just described is exactly what she does in most of her books too.
Oh, no, I haven't, but I have been meaning to read more of her. So I will put that on my list. That sounds really good though.
Yeah, because she uses like a photograph to bounce off, like find a version of a memory. And then who knows? I mean, it's marketed as fiction, but she just kind of goes from there and tells a story. But yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I think, you know, you were asking about memory, and I was thinking actually that something that I would talk a lot about in the past, something that I kept in the past was this like food journal. I would actually just write down everything that I ate. And this wasn't like a health food thing. It mm-hmm. wasn't like a sort of like diet imposed thing. It was more that I think I had heard that, you know, Andy Warhol had this sort of scent diary where he would wear certain perfumes for like periods of his life and then be able to think back on those periods with more like vividness. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted something like that. Couldn't afford perfume, but I thought maybe if I wrote down everything that I ate, I could look back and just remember how those days were, like who I was with, how I felt. And it was almost this, just this compulsion to try to have a more perfect memory. And I think that's something that feels like years ago now, and like is not something that I do anymore, although I do keep a lot of, you know, journals in other ways. I think mm-hmm. I'm less obsessed with a perfect memory because I'm realizing that that's actually, you know, something that technology helps with a lot. And when I think about AI, I think of, oh, here's something that has a quote unquote like perfect memory, right? Like mm-hmm. it's eating up all of our literary work and it's spitting it back out as this like Frankenstein creation. And that's what it would look like for a writer to have perfect memory, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm sort of more interested in the fact that we are imperfect in these ways, right? And despite that imperfection of like having those receipts, having those perfect records, like how can we sort of meet one another where we are in relationships?
That's really interesting because I was about to just talk about the food diary because you wrote in a piece for Lucky Peach ages ago called All You've Eaten. The way you put it was writing down food was a way to turn my life into facts. If I had all the facts, I could keep them straight. I guess now that you've just said that, how does that sit with you? And I guess what has changed in your relationship to both the food diary as well as memory as a whole?
Yeah, I think I've just outgrown that in so many ways. I mean, I think that sort of was coming out of just so many anxieties, right, about I just wanted to be a person with like this very clear and comprehensible story. You know, mm-hmm. there's the desire to have everything make sense, especially when you are sort of, when you're just like a younger person, probably like around mm-hmm. around your age. I think I just wanted to like, I felt like adrift and like I wanted to make sense of things. And this very obsessive diary was one way that I could just have control or like feel that I had control. Yeah, I think that one thing that I have learned just getting older is that it's really impossible to sort of retain that control over your life. I mean, nothing really is in our control, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, some things are, but like life is sort of going to do what it's going to do, and you can't really shape it entirely. There's lots of surprises and things. And so I think, I mean, it was something that I learned, I think, also through writing Goodbye Vitamin, just that maybe it matters less how perfectly remembered everything is or like perfectly experienced, and just the things that really matter are just like these moments between people and, mm-hmm. And whether or not they're remembered perfectly, like the way that they actually happened. It's more about like a feeling and an experience of being with somebody, especially like someone that you really love.
Lovely. I want to switch over to, we sort of talked about food, but focus in on food here. It permeates throughout your work. You're an editor at Lucky Peach, which is a magazine founded by the chef Dave Chang. And then food is just all over your first novel, from braising pork to jellyfish to canned food. I believe you also, braising pork also appears in the new novel. And also you edited a cookbook for Lucky Peach about eggs, which was great to read. How did you start writing about food?
I mean, I love food. I love eating food. I've always been a big fan. I kind of stumbled into writing about food. I had moved back to San Francisco after an MFA program that I mm-hmm. did in Florida. And I was sort of casting about for jobs. I don't have so many skills, but I am, you know, a pretty good eater and cook and things like that. And so I was thinking, oh, maybe I'll work in a restaurant. I will do something food service related while I write Goodbye Vitamin on the side. Mm-hmm. Definitely easier said than done. It's really hard to work in a restaurant. And I think I was so naive about it. I thought, oh, I'll work at the restaurant at night and then I will plenty of daytime hours to work on the book. And it's just not really, it wasn't really as simple as that. It's really hard to just like muster the energy to do writing after this like physical labor. So yeah. I actually got back in touch with a person that I had met a few summers before in San Francisco while I was interning at a magazine called McSweeney's, which is the literary magazine. Mm-hmm. And this person, Chris Ying, mentioned to me that he was starting a food magazine, a food quarterly, and just asked if, I'd be interested in working for him. And so I think there was some trial, you know, some, mm-hmm. I don't know, articles or something like that. But we just were sort of off to the races after that. They had made one issue of the magazine and then quickly it became clear that they needed to make a lot more. And so I was brought in as the managing editor. Mm-hmm. And this was like something that, yeah, I didn't have a lot of experience with going into the job. I really liked food. And so I was sort of an amateur. Yeah, I don't know, an amateur everything. I mean, I liked food. I read a lot of food magazines and cookbooks, and I sort of tried to eat as widely as I could, you know, mm-hmm. on my very limited budget. But this was a job that I sort of like learned on the job, you know. Mm-hmm. And before that, I had actually done some music criticism. I'd written for various online music publications about indie music. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like pretty flexible when it came to like writing nonfiction, like as a career, basically. But the food was obviously, it's something we do every day. We all have to do it. I got this very quick education in it while working at that magazine.
Yeah. When you talk about music criticism, I'm not curious because Lucky Peach was very unorthodox in a lot of ways. I've tried to scrounge what I could find online, but it's not very easy to find things from online. But what do you see as the through line, I guess, between music criticism and food? Because they almost feel like very different worlds to write about.
Yeah.
Or just any other art criticism in general. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they're different, but they're also they're also similar in that they both require a kind of like confidence in what you're saying, mm-hmm. or just like maybe a sort of conviction in terms of what you find good, mm-hmm. you know. So with music criticism, I was always like sort of trying to persuade people that this is a good album, or this album isn't so good. And with the food writing, it's quite similar. You know, you're having to describe something that the person who's reading can't experience with their own senses. Mm-hmm. Like when I think back on it, no, I just think, wow, like who let me write those music reviews? I was so like overly confident almost. And so sure of like what I believed in and what was good and what was bad. And I think now I would approach it very differently, maybe with like more humility. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You mentioned Chris Ying, so now I have to ask, how did you get roped into doing Recipe Club? Which, for people who don't know, is just a food show that involves a lot of mishaps and cooking a lot of things that you don't really expect, and it's very addicting to listen to. So yeah, how did you get roped into doing that?
Yeah. Well, they, Chris and Dave have been working together on this media company called Major Domo Studios. Mm-hmm. And it was during the pandemic, Chris reached out and asked if I was interested in experimenting with them on this podcast. Mm-hmm. And the idea was it would be a podcast about food that was sort of like a book club. And in those pandemic days, we would take one theme ingredient and then we would bring three different recipes to the table. Like each member of the group would bring a recipe to the table. Everyone would cook the recipes. So we would each cook like three turkeys or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. And then we would discuss them like a book club. And there's a sort of competitive element to it. It was a pandemic. I mean, there was not much going on in my life, except that I was trying to write this novel. So I said, sure. And I actually said, sure, in part because I like don't love talking on podcasts. I find Lovely. Them kind of, I mean, you're a very wonderful interlocutor, but I find them really stressful because I'm a writer, you know, like I think my way through things like in writing. And I'm so envious of people who are really good at just talking off the cuff and mm-hmm. yeah, like articulate verbally. But I think that for me, especially growing up as like this immigrant kid, it was always like a little scary to me to just be asked what I thought. Like I think mm-hmm. even as an adult, I sort of hesitate before I say something because I'm thinking back to like, or it's not that I'm thinking back, but there's this sort of like visceral, like memory of like being a kid and being made fun of for saying things the wrong way and things like that. So I actually said yes to Recipe Club in part because I don't think I've ever said this out loud, in part because I just wanted to like get over my phobia of podcasts. And I thought it was a really good way to do that, you know, just among friends and in this sort of like lower stakes way where we didn't have to talk about ourselves necessarily, but we could just talk about the things that we had made and cooked. And so that was where it started. It's been really fun, very goofy, mm-hmm. but yeah, and like just completely different from writing fiction every morning, you know, it's just like a different, it's fun to like do something so different from that.
Yeah, and now it seems that most dishes there just end up getting nuked in the microwave and turning into some interesting concoction.
Yeah.
It's great to listen to.
That's Dave. That's Dave's influence. He loves the microwave.
I want to end on your new novel, Real Americans, which is out from Knopf on April 30th. It spans multiple generations. You switch from the quotidian to the generational and tells the story of Chinese immigrants on the cusp of the 21st century as well as beyond. You're interrogating American identity, Asian American identity, and all its nuances. Talk to me about that. Where did this type of novel emerge from? And I guess what also changed in your writing process from Goodbye Vitamin to this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this book is just so different from the first book.
Yes.
I do think if you look closely, there are a lot of overlapping themes. But the like format of the book is so different. The way it's written is so different.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing this book in December of 2016.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So right after the election. And I don't think I was consciously thinking I'm writing about the situation that we're living through.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that like subconsciously, I was writing towards something that I just really wanted to read in the moment, which was like a book that was much more plot driven and sort of immersive.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that required, you know, like sustained attention. I think during that time, you know, December 2016, that whole year, I felt so like fragmented. You know, we were constantly doom scrolling or checking the news or thinking, you know, just checking for what Donald Trump was up to. You know, it was just like a very scattered, a scattered year. And so I think I really wanted to write something that felt like a way to, be really, I just wanted to write something really like absorbing, essentially, and that would sort of like take you away from that like fragmented internet-y. Like I wouldn't have written Goodbye Vitamin again because it was sort of like almost too internet-y in the wake of that year. So personally, I wanted to write something like really immersive. But I do think ultimately, you know, those themes that were in the air then, just like collectively for the country, and are still things that we're thinking about, you know, going into 2024, just things like power and privilege and immigration to America.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those themes that were in the air in 2016 were what informed the novel. And the novel is like really, it's about these two families. One is an immigrant family. The other is a sort of like established wealthy pharmaceuticals empire family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of about what happens when those two worlds intersect. And hopefully it feels unexpected. Like it kind of starts out almost like a romance, but then shifts into something else and then shifts again into something else. So that was my hope that it wasn't just, my hope is just that it isn't just one thing, you know, it's sort of this, like many layered thing that shows a sort of variety of experiences.
Yeah, wonderful. And then my final question that I ask everyone, but I'm going to add a section for you. What have you been reading, watching, or listening to lately that you've been excited about? And what have you eaten lately that's been interesting?
Oh my gosh. Okay. What have I been reading? I recently read a book. This is a debut novel by a fellow Knopf author who's also a poet, Kaveh Akbar.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a novel called Martyr. It's about this sort of young Iranian poet who is sort of like obsessed with martyrdom.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to say more. I might be giving away some of the plot, but he's sort of a little bit adrift, you know, in that sort of Goodbye Vitamin vein. I think that this, the main character of this book and Ruth in my book would have a lot to talk about.
Okay.
They're both sort of, adrift and figuring things out, but it's a really beautifully written book and it just has so much like packed into it. I really love it when a book feels just like very rich and lived in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutely what this book is. Yeah. So that comes to mind. I mean, boringly, like I'm just like looking for some new TV. If you have recommendations for me, what have you been watching?
What have I been watching? I feel like during school years, I just revert back to 90s comedies of like Seinfeld and Frasier that I can aimlessly put on while I'm working.
Yeah, I think there's something just in the air right now. A lot of people just need to be rewatching stuff because I'm in the same boat and I've been watching, this is a little embarrassing to admit, but I've been watching episodes of Monk.
Okay.
Which, do you know what that is?
I know what it is. I haven't seen it though.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like very like, you know, like network TV, like pretty formulaic in some ways. I don't know. Every episode is a new mystery. So not necessarily, but yeah, it's just like very predictable, but really comforting. Yeah. So that's what I've been watching. And what have I been eating and loving? I'm going to look in my pantry. You know what? I'm currently growing persimmons. We have this persimmon tree in our backyard, and it's full of persimmons. There's just hundreds and hundreds of persimmons. So we have just started harvesting them, and I'm not totally sick of them yet, but I do really like persimmons.
Lovely. Wonderful. I believe that is all. Thank you so much for being here. This is great.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's our show. Special thanks to Rachel Kong for joining me on this episode. To learn more about her work, pre-order her book, and see a list of her recommendations, visit the show notes. Cultural Mixtapes is written and produced by me, Tejas Srinivasan. The music you heard on today's episode was Beethoven's Sonata No. 26 and Chopin's Sonata No. 2, recorded by me. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, review, and share on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. Thank you very much for listening.